Chapter 9. Actually, for 5 seconds or so, wish themselves dead. Taking the ground is the professional expression for a ship that is stranded in gentle circumstances. But the feeling is more as if the ground had taken hold of her. It is for those on her deck a surprising sensation. It is as if your feet had been caught in an imponderable snare. You feel the balance of your body threatened, and the steady poise of your mind is destroyed at once. This sensation lasts only a second, for even while you stagger, something seems to turn over in your head, bringing uppermost the mental exclamation, full of astonishment and dismay, "By Jove! She's on the ground! And that is very terrible. After all, the only mission of a seaman's calling is to keep ship's keels off the ground. Thus the moment of her stranding takes away from him every excuse for his continued existence. To keep ships afloat is his business. It is his trust. It is the effective formula of the bottom of all these vague impulses, dreams, and delusions that go to the making up of a boy's vocation. The grip of the land upon the keel of your ship, even if nothing worse comes of it than the wear and tear of tackle and the loss of time, remains in a seaman's memory an indelibly fixed taste of disaster. Stranded within the meaning of this paper stands for a more or less excusable mistake. A ship may be driven ashore by stress of weather. It is a catastrophe, a defeat. To be unashore has the littleness, poignancy, and bitterness of human error. XXI. That is why your strandings are for the most part so unexpected. In fact, they are all unexpected, except those heralded by some short glimpse of the danger, full of agitation and excitement, like an awakening from a dream of incredible folly. The land suddenly at night looms upright over your bows, or perhaps the cry of broken water ahead is raised, and some long mistake, some complicated edifice of self-delusion, overconfidence, and wrong reasoning is brought down in a fatal shock, and the heart-searing experience of your ship's keel scraping and scrunching over, say, a coral reef. It is a sound, for its size, far more terrific to your soul than that of a world coming violently to an end. But out of that chaos your belief in your own prudence and sagacity reasserts itself. You ask yourself, where on earth did I get to? How on earth did I get there? With a conviction that it could not be your own act, that there has been at work some mysterious conspiracy of accident, that the charts are all wrong, and if the charts are not wrong, that land and sea have changed their places, that your misfortune shall forever remain inexplicable, since you have lived always with the sense of your trust, the last thing on closing your eyes, the first on opening them, as if your mind had kept firm hold of your responsibility during the hours of sleep. You contemplate mentally your mischance, till little by little your mood changes. Cold doubt steals into the very marrow of your bones. You see the inexplicable fact in another light. That is the time when you ask yourself, how on earth could I have been fool enough to get there? And you are ready to renounce all belief in your good sense, in your knowledge, in your fidelity, in what you thought till then was the best in you, giving you the daily bread of life, and the moral support of other men's confidence. The ship is lost or not lost. Once stranded, you have to do your best by her. She may be saved by your efforts, by your resource and fortitude bearing up against the heavy weight of guilt and failure. And there are justifiable strandings in fogs, on uncharted seas, on dangerous shores, through treacherous tides. But, saved or not saved, there remains with her commander a distinct sense of loss, a flavor in the mouth of the real, abiding danger that lurks in all the forms of human existence. It is an acquisition to that feeling. A man may be the better for it, but he will not be the same. Damocles has seen the sword suspended by a hair over his head, and though a good man need not be made less valuable by such a knowledge, the feast shall not henceforth have the same flavor. Years ago I was concerned as chief mate in a case of stranding which was not fatal to the ship. We went to work for 10 hours on end, laying out anchors in readiness to heave off at high water. While I was still busy about the decks forward, I heard the steward at my elbow saying, "He captain asks whether you mean to come in, sir, and have something to eat today." I went into the cuddy. My captain sat at the head of the table like a statue. There was a strange motionlessness of everything in that pretty little cabin. The swing table, which for 70-odd days had been always on the move, if ever so little, hung quite still above the soup tureen. Nothing could have altered the rich color of my commander's complexion, laid on generously by wind and sea, but between the two tufts of fair hair above his ears, his skull, generally suffused with the hue of blood, shone dead white, like a dome of ivory. And he looked strangely untidy. I perceived he had not shaved himself that day, and yet the wildest motion of the ship in the most stormy latitudes we had passed through never made him miss one single morning ever since we left the channel. The fact must be that a commander cannot possibly shave himself when his ship is aground. I have commanded ships myself, but I don't know, I have never tried to shave in my life. He did not offer to help me or himself till I had coughed markedly several times. I talked to him professionally in a cheery tone, and ended with the confident assertion, "We shall get her off before midnight, sir." He smiled faintly without looking up, and muttered as if to himself, "Yes, yes, the captain put the ship ashore, and we got her off." Then, raising his head, he attacked grumpily the steward, a lanky, anxious youth with a long, pale face and two big front teeth. "What makes this soup so bitter? I am surprised the mate can swallow the beastly stuff. I'm sure the cooks ladled some salt water into it by mistake." The charge was so outrageous that the steward, for all answer, only dropped his eyelids bashfully. There was nothing the matter with the soup. I had a second helping. My heart was warm with hours of hard work at the head of a willing crew. I was elated with having handled heavy anchors, cables, boats without the slightest hitch, pleased with having laid out scientifically bower, stream, and kedge exactly where I believed they would do most good. On that occasion, the bitter taste of a stranding was not for my mouth. That experience came later, and it was only then that I understood the loneliness of the man in charge. It's the captain who puts the ship ashore, it's we who get her off. XXII. It seems to me that no man born and truthful to himself could declare that he ever saw the sea looking young as the earth looks young in spring. But some of us, regarding the ocean with understanding and affection, have seen it looking old, as if the immemorial ages had been stirred up from the undisturbed bottom of ooze. For it is a gale of wind that makes the sea look old. From a distance of years, looking at the remembered aspects of the storms lived through, it is that impression which disengages itself clearly from the great body of impressions left by many years of intimate contact. If you would know the age of the earth, look upon the sea in a storm. The grayness of the whole immense surface, the wind furrows upon the faces of the waves, the great masses of foam, tossed about and waving, like matted white locks, give to the sea in a gale an appearance of hoary age, lusterless, dull, without gleams, as though it had been created before light itself. Looking back after much love and much trouble, the instinct of primitive man, who seeks to personify the forces of nature for his affection and for his fear, is awakened again in the breast of one civilized beyond that stage even in his infancy. One seems to have known gales as enemies, and even as enemies one embraces them in that affectionate regret which clings to the past. Gales have their personalities, and, after all, perhaps it is not strange, for, when all is said and done, they are adversaries whose wiles you must defeat, whose violence you must resist, and yet with whom you must live in the intimacies of nights and days. Here speaks the man of masts and sails, to whom the sea is not a navigable element, but an intimate companion. The length of passages, the growing sense of solitude, the close dependence upon the very forces that, friendly today, without changing their nature, by the mere putting forth of their might, Become dangerous tomorrow. Make for that sense of fellowship which modern seamen, good men as they are, cannot hope to know. And, besides, your modern ship which is a steamship makes her passages on other principles than yielding to the weather and humoring the sea. She receives smashing blows, but she advances. It is a slogging fight, and not a scientific campaign. The machinery, the steel, the fire, the steam, have stepped in between the man and the sea. A modern fleet of ships does not so much make use of the sea as exploit a highway. The modern ship is not the sport of the waves. Let us say that each of her voyages is a triumphant progress, and yet it is a question whether it is not a more subtle and more human triumph to be the sport of the waves and yet survive, achieving your end. In his own time a man is always very modern. Whether the seaman of 300 years hence will have the faculty of sympathy it is impossible to say. An incorrigible mankind hardens its heart in the progress of its own perfectibility. How will they feel on seeing the illustrations to the sea novels of our day, or of our yesterday? It is impossible to guess. But the seamen of the last generation, brought into sympathy with the caravels of ancient time by his sailing ship, their lineal descendant, cannot look upon those lumbering forms navigating the naive seas of ancient woodcuts without a feeling of surprise, of affectionate derision, envy, and admiration. For those things, whose unmanageableness, even when represented on paper, makes one gasp with a sort of amused horror, were manned by men who are his direct professional ancestors. No, the seamen of 300 years hence will probably be neither touched nor moved to derision, affection, or admiration. They will glance at the photogravures of our nearly defunct sailing ships with a cold, inquisitive and indifferent eye. Our ships of yesterday will stand to their ships as no lineal ancestors, but as mere predecessors whose course will have been run, and the race extinct. Whatever craft he handles with skill, the seaman of the future shall be, not our descendant, but only our successor. XXIII. And so much depends upon the craft which, made by man, is one with man, that the sea shall wear for him another aspect. I remember once seeing the commander, officially the master, by courtesy the captain of a fine iron ship of the old wool fleet, shaking his head at a very pretty brigantine. She was bound the other way. She was a taut, trim, neat little craft, extremely well kept, and on that serene evening, when we passed her close, she looked the embodiment of coquettish comfort on the sea. It was somewhere near the cape being, of course, the Cape of Good Hope, the Cape of Storms of its Portuguese discoverer. And whether it is that the word storm should not be pronounced upon the sea, where the storms dwell thickly, or because men are shy of confessing their good hopes, it has become the nameless cape, the Cape Tautcourt. The other great cape of the world, strangely enough, is seldom if ever called a cape. We say, a voyage round the horn, semicolon, we rounded the horn, we got a frightful battering off the horn, but rarely Cape Horn, and, indeed, with some reason, for Cape Horn is as much an island as a cape. The third stormy cape of the world, which is the Leeuwin, receives generally its full name, as if to console its second-rate dignity. These are the capes that look upon the gales. The little brigantine, then, had doubled the cape. Perhaps she was coming from Port Elizabeth, from East London, who knows? It was many years ago, but I remember well the captain of the Wool Clipper nodding at her with the words, "Fancy having to go about the sea in a thing like that." He was a man brought up in big deep water ships, and the size of the craft under his feet was a part of his conception of the sea. His own ship was certainly big as ships went then. He may have thought of the size of his cabin, or unconsciously, perhaps have conjured up a vision of a vessel, so small tossing amongst the great seas. I didn't inquire, and to a young second mate, the captain of the little pretty brigantine, sitting astride a camp stool with his chin resting on his hands that were crossed upon the rail, might have appeared a minor king amongst men. We passed her within earshot, without a hail, reading each other's names with the naked eye. Some years later, the second mate, the recipient of that almost involuntary mutter, could have told his captain that a man brought up in big ships may yet take a peculiar delight in what we should both then have called a small craft. Probably the captain of the big ship would not have understood very well. His answer would have been a gruff, "Give me size," as I heard another man reply to a remark praising the handiness of a small vessel. It was not a love of the grandiose, or the prestige attached to the command of great tonnage, for he continued, with an air of disgust and contempt, "Why, you get flung out of your bunk as likely as not in any sort of heavy weather." I don't know. I remember a few nights in my lifetime, and in a big ship, too, as big as they made them then, when one did not get flung out of one's bed simply because one never even attempted to get in. One had been made too weary, too hopeless, to try. The expedient of turning your bedding out onto a damp floor and lying on it there was no earthly good, since you could not keep your place, or get a second's rest in that or any other position. But of the delight of seeing a small craft run bravely amongst the great seas there can be no question to him whose soul does not dwell ashore. Thus I well remember a 3 days' run got out of a little bark of 400 tons somewhere between the islands of St. Paul and Amsterdam and Cape Otway on the Australian coast. It was a hard, long gale, grey clouds and green sea, heavy weather undoubtedly, but still what a sailor would call manageable. Under two lower topsails and a reefed foresail the bark seemed to race with a long, steady sea that did not becalm her in the troughs. The solemn thundering combers caught her up from astern, passed her with a fierce boiling up of foam level with the bulwarks, swept on the head with a swish and a roar. And the little vessel, dipping her jib boom into the tumbling froth, would go on running in a smooth, glassy hollow, a deep valley between two ridges of the sea, hiding the horizon ahead and astern. There was such fascination in her pluck, nimbleness, the continual exhibition of unfailing seaworthiness, in the semblance of courage and endurance, that I could not give up the delight of watching her run through the three. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.